Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo. Today we're going to be discussing a subject that so many people are fascinated with. And historically it has been a challenge, but I think we've got some new perspectives that are intriguing and fascinating, as is my guest who, along with his wife, have done a tremendous amount of research. What am I talking about? It's the fabled area called Atlantis. And the book is titled Atlantis Beneath the Ice, The Fate of a Lost Continent. Rand Flemeth, I'd like to welcome you to the show.
Thank you very much for being here.
Well, you know what? I really was intrigued when I heard the title, number one, Atlas Beneath the Ice. But also that it was revised and expanded. It had previously been published under When the Sky Fell. Is that true?
Yes, that's right. Yep, 1995.
And that was published in 1981?
1995.
Oh, 1995. Okay.
Yep.
I had the date wrong on it. Well, Atlantis is just amazing. Now, you're a librarian.
Yes.
You also have written another book about Atlantis called The Atlantis Blueprint. And you've been on the History Channel, the Discovery Channel, and a lot of, you know, big networks. And your wife, Rose, she's an author herself, and she's a two-time winner of the Canadian Arts Council Grant for Fiction. You live in B.C., and what made the two of you decide to take on this project? Why was it significant for both of you to be involved in this research, and why did you take something that was published in 1995 and bring it up to date?
It was almost accidental that we came into the question of Atlantis. I was working at the library in Greater Victoria Public Library, and I came across a book about Atlantis, and I just was looking through it, and I came across a map that was published in 1665 of Atlantis. And I thought not much of it, really, just sort of thought, well, I'd never seen a map of Atlantis before. I'd heard of the lost continent. And then about a week later, across the counter comes Charles Hapgood's Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings, which is all about ancient maps and their role in history. And one of the things that it included was an ice-free map of Antarctica, which I had never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately my mind went back to the other book, and I went up and I grabbed the book, and then I started to compare the ice-free shape of Antarctica to this 1665 map of Atlantis, and they were so similar in my mind that I thought I had something that I rushed home and I showed Rose, and we were just sort of like, wow, this is bizarre, you know, because we have no idea how this could happen, because there's 300 years between these two maps. One is showing Atlantis. Apparently, the author thought it was in the mid-Atlantic, and this other map is showing Antarctica without its ice, and the configuration of Antarctica without its ice and its adjoining ice islands look just like the map from 1665. So that's what got us started on it. And then I, of course, started to look into the question of Atlantis and soon learned how it came from Plato and Plato's account and read Plato's accounts. And as I was doing that, I started to look into other stories of the Great Flood, because I considered the Atlantis story to be part of a larger tradition in world mythology, with regard to the Great Flood.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that was interesting about the Great Flood was that there was like a half a dozen myths from around the world, and two of them in British Columbia, one of them in Washington State as well, it's the Okanagan people, had stories about an island that existed before the flood. And that started to make me think, well, now maybe there's something more to this than meets the eye. So I really started to do a lot of investigation. I read World Mythology for about a year. I read that Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings. And when I finished his book, Charles Apcutt's book, I noticed that he had written another book called The Earth's Shifting Crust. So that was interesting. That sort of sounded interesting. And I had difficulty getting a hold of it, but eventually I did get a hold of a copy. And that, to me, it seemed like the mechanism that might explain how Antarctica was once Atlantis. So Rose and I wrote up what we thought we knew from all the stuff that we had been doing. We wrote a letter to Charles Hapgood. This is in now 1977. And he wrote back, and he was thrilled that we were doing something with his research. And then we corresponded with him for over the next 5 years. Rose and I found that in the late 70s, it was just taking so long to get books from other libraries, because a lot of the books that I had to read were quite rare. And we always wanted to go try out living in London. So we sold up everything, and because Rose was born in England, we were able to get the dual citizenship, and we went off to London to see if we could use the British Museum, which was the mecca for librarians of old books. And at this time, it was still in the British Museum library. The library was still in the British Museum. And it's a beautiful structure. It's like a great dome, and it's got this robin egg roof. And the books that we were taking 6 months to come in Canada were arriving into my desk in an hour. So it was, we settled in. We thought we'd stay for maybe 3 or 4 months and try to get some research done and get jobs. We ended up staying for 4 years.
Amazing.
And during that time, we just developed the whole theory, which eventually, when we got back to Canada, was published in 1995 as When the Sky Fell, In Search of Atlantis. That did very well, and then the company that owned the rights to it went bankrupt. So the book, which had been doing very well, went out of print. And so we decided, well, maybe we should update it. And now we had something different. Like, we're talking about the last 5 years here now. We had the Internet. And being able to get research done with the Internet compared to pre-Internet days is quite amazingly different. So the kind of research that was taking us months and months and months back in the late 70s and 80s, we were doing in weeks here. So much more information was discovered, and also a lot of scientific things have happened, events have happened as well, so that we felt as if now we had enough material to do a whole new edition of the book. And so that's how Atlantis Beneath the Ice came about.
You have just some really amazing history in here, and various points of information that you discovered. I think that's what is so intriguing. It takes so much time to do research, even if you're fortunate enough like you were. And there's a wonderful story about how you got the financial wherewithal to be able to stay in London for 4 years because of this unique book that you bought. But that's another story for another time. But here's all of this information, and the gentleman that you got this rare book from in England. Here's this man sitting down in a basement that has got this collection of materials, and so many times that happens. There are people who cherish books so much, or maps, things like this, that if some ruler of some land says everything's to be destroyed, which has happened quite a bit throughout history, there are those that will siphon them out, hide them, throw in fake papers so that they can preserve what's there in the... That it ends up traveling a unique journey. Sometimes I wonder if books could talk, what they would tell. in the way of adventures that they have had, the various places that they've been cloistered away, whether it's a monastery, someone's basement, you know, in a library somewhere where somebody forgot to take it out and put it on a shelf and it's been in a drawer for 500 years. I mean, all it's just amazing to me how this information seemingly will sort of rise up to the surface like water sifting through sand. It's just intriguing to me. It's really an adventure when you think about what you and your wife have done.
Well, that experience was so almost unreal. It seemed going down. It was like it was quite near the right central London, and we went down in this. It seemed like a dungeon, you know. And as we went down, there's books on the stairs. There's books everywhere, and they're all old books. And this old gentleman, he was just so charming. He just the fact that we had been willing to go down in there, he was willing to help us with anything we wanted. We said, you know, is there any chance that you could find this book, which was Athanasius Kircher's Mundus Subterraneus, in which the map of Atlantis originally appeared in 1665. Uh-huh. And you know, he just shuffles around and he says, okay, hold on. And, you know, about 10 minutes later, he comes back with it, and it's a huge book. I mean, it's, let's see, it must have been 4 feet high and 3 feet high and 2 feet wide. It was just huge.
Wow.
Really
thick.
That's
a big one.
It was a really thick thing. We had to get a special case to carry it. But we had that for quite a while, time went by, and then we ran out of money, so we had to sell it. But we took it to, I think it was Sotheby's, and we did very well with it. It was enough to stay on for longer, and we also got jobs as well. But that was quite an adventure, and how this guy could remember or find this book is beyond me. As a librarian, it didn't seem to be any order to where his books were. So it was quite amazing. It was great, a great story. And I remember when we got out of there, and we went into a park, and I just, you know, we were both sitting on the park together looking through this book, and there it was, there's the map, you know, and that confirmed it to me. Wow, you know, here's this map, 1665, and it's showing basically what Antarctica looks like without the ice. And I just figured, well, that was really a great moment in London, and we really enjoyed our time there. But we missed, of course, the British Columbia, and, you know, we love this area so much. But when I did get back, I followed up on some more of that research on the mythology of the people of British Columbia and Washington State, the Okanagan, and they had a story about an island called Sumatuiwula, which was an island that existed before the flood, and there was a change in the sky, a change in the sun, and then they were forced to leave this homeland and in boats made their way to this area of the world and then went up into the mountains. And it's not like they're islanders themselves. The Okanagan people are not, you know, really from the islands. They're on mainland, really. The fact that their homeland was an island is significant. And then as we were doing some more research, we found out that this sound, Sumatuiwula, na-na-na-na-na-na, showed up in Japan under a different name. It was Onogorojima, and that was their original island homeland before the flood. And so we thought that was interesting. And then even further, when we got to the Vedic literature of ancient India and ancient Iran, we learned of Ariano Dejo. So in each case, you had this same sound, da-da-da-da-da-da. All, in every case, they're referring to an island that existed before the flood that people were forced to flee from, and in boats, and they ultimately landed in a new land to start life over. So, in the case of the Ariana Vesio, they mention that the original island homeland was covered in a thick blanket of snow and ice after the deluge.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these stories from North America, Asia, and the Middle East, all referring to this lost island paradise that existed before the flood. So we put Atlantis's the story of Atlantis in that larger framework of world mythology.
It is so intriguing that Plato is given credit for writing about this, and of course, maybe if the library at Alexandria had not been destroyed, we would have even had more information that was accessible to us. But the reality is we're dealing with today, there is so much so far back that is underwater, but in your story, it's under ice. And there was a shift in the earth. There was that tip in the axis. And that's not the only time it's ever happened, where we had tremendous weather change and that there was so much that went on, and it happened so fast.
Yeah, and the thing that's really significant as far as I'm concerned is that Plato's account pinpoints the century when this occurred. He claims that it happened at 9,600 BC in our time scale. And the thing about that's so startling is that it's only since the Second World War, with the use of radiocarbon dating, that we were able to determine that at 9,600 BC, there was indeed great and vast climatic changes. The ice cap in North America melted. The ocean level rose 100 meters. There was tidal waves and floods, mass extinctions. And also, Plato goes on to say in the Laws that after the destruction that followed the flood, the survivors landed in the highlands and began to start agriculture again.
Mm-hmm.
And now, we now know that started around 9,600 BC, and in the highlands. So Plato's account includes information that has only been verified by radiocarbon dating in the past 50, 60 years. But his, of course, account is that it was originally came out in 4th century B.C. So he just guessed, it seems, the very exact date that now modern science is saying all these things did happen.
Mm-hmm. It is so absolutely amazing. I think of how Edgar Cayce so many years ago said that in the 20th and 21st centuries, the technology was going to enable us to be able to find out about things that we had no concept. We just couldn't, because we didn't have the technology for communication. And like you said, the internet, there are so many things that are available today. We have aspects of technology that can read to various layers of Earth substance. We can see cities underwater. They're discovering cities under sand now. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if we discover something under the Antarctic or the solar caps, or the polar caps, excuse me. It's just so much. It's so intriguing. We live in such an interesting time, but you and your wife, with all of your research, found that there was monument building and a rebooting of agriculture happening at the same time, 11,600 years ago.
Yes.
And you say, that's what you perceived. Those were the survivors that wanted to pass on their knowledge. And there are so many cultures throughout the world. South America, they had someone that came in and taught them their agriculture. You look at the architectural designs for water flow, preservation of foods. It's up in the Andes.
I know. It's astonishingly sophisticated.
That's right. That's the right word, sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
And someone managed to understand how it goes, and it's still working today.
And the thing that's as well that goes along with that is that the most sophisticated and the biggest blocks of stone and everything date around 9,600 BC, and then after that time, as you move towards our time, it's not like those abilities improve; they actually decline. So it seems as though some of these activities in South America, also in the Middle East as well, and in Egypt, all point to the last gasps, if you like, of an advanced civilization. As they fled their homeland, they took with them some sort of technology that would gave them the capacity to construct monumental architecture that we, even today, in many of the cases, are not capable of reproducing.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a look at the temple in front of the Sphinx, for example, some of those blocks weigh 180 metric tons apiece. I mean, this is incredible weight. I mean, there's only like a half a dozen engineering companies in the world that would even take on moving one of them. But mm-hmm. they're all put together like they're just as if they were lifted out as little bricks and put into place, and they're put in perfectly. This is just astonishing achievements that have no precedent. There's not like before that time you see anything like that. But then suddenly, around this time, you find it in Egypt. There's this one in Turkey called Göbekli Tepe that is just astonishingly complex. It's about 22 acres. It dates exactly to this century that Plato's account gives for the destruction of Atlantis. And here you have the same sort of pattern happening. You have these great big they're 18 feet high, and they weigh about 16 tons each, and they're in a T-shape. They're carved out of granite, and they're moved about a third of a mile up a hill, and they're put into a circular formation that looks something like Stonehenge. And then from that point on, in terms of time, as you go towards our time, all the other efforts to try to do that are much smaller. Smaller mm-hmm. and smaller, and then eventually they just can't do even little ones. So you had, and then at the same time, within 60 miles of that very site, you have some of the earliest agriculture in the world, with wheat, barley, goats, pigs, all showing up right near this monumental architecture. So prior to this century, there was no monumental building anywhere in the world that we know of. There was no agriculture that we know of anywhere in the world. And then suddenly, at the very same century that Plato says Atlantis is destroyed, we have this earliest monumental architecture in the world and agriculture happening at the same time. And to me, that's not coincidence. Because when you say, like you mentioned, the central Andes, Lake Titicaca and Tiahuanaco mm-hmm. there, and Sacsayhuaman, and the huge, gigantic stones that are put together as if they were just, little toys or something, but which today, and at like altitudes of like, really high altitudes.
Right.
People, like, if I was there, I probably would be, fainting from not being able to breathe. Most people, you have to get adjusted to be able to that kind of high altitude. But here they were moving incredible stones, and in the case this particular case, they were down a valley, up a river, across the river, and then that's where you find the quarry. The quarry is on down the valley into the river, and then up on another mound. So they had to transport these 60-ton blocks of a stone down one mountain, across the river, and then up a mountain to get them up to where they are. If you gave an engineering company $1 billion and told them there would be $1 billion bonus if they could accomplish it in a year or even 5 years, no engineering company today could do that.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
there is, I believe, evidence around the world that Atlantis was an advanced civilization, a civilization that had technologies that we have yet to rediscover. I think in terms of the things that have contributed to us the most, it would be agriculture, mm-hmm. because it was at this time that agriculture began around the world, and it all happens in the high altitudes as well. It's almost all of the plants and domesticated plants and animals that we eat were originally domesticated at 1,500 meters above sea level, and the reason was, of course, that people were afraid to be in the lowlands, because in the lowlands, the rising ocean, because the ice sheets were melting and the tidal waves that were happening, the tsunamis that were happening, made people were just afraid to be near the ocean. So they moved up into the highlands, and they had to do something for food. And it was at this point, and the story is usually told is the same all around the world, that the people arrive with these skills to develop agriculture, and they contribute to the local population and they merge with the local population, and they start agriculture. The other thing that survives is this incredible knowledge of astronomy, you have things like the Mayan calendar, the knowledge of astronomy that seems way beyond what we think that people in ancient times could have possibly have known. Knowledges star systems, the Sirius story, the story of the Sirius being a binary star, and people in Africa and an African tribe in Africa knowing that this was a binary star, and we only learned this, in the 20th century. And there's one other, a third thing that is a legacy from Atlantis, and that is the ancient maps the maps like the Kirker map of Atlantis. Many of the maps around from the 16th century or so demonstrate knowledge of the Earth's geography that is beyond the technology of Europeans at the time. It wasn't until the 1770s that the Europeans were capable of mapping continents. But we have maps from the 1513, for example, that show accurately, within a half a degree of longitude, the outlines of the eastern half of South America and some subglacial features of Antarctica, that is, what it's like under the ice.
Mm-hmm.
And these have been, this is, of course, Charles Hapgood's work, and he had taken up the study of ancient maps from another guy, Arlington Mallory, who had enlisted the help of the U.S. Navy. And the U.S. Navy reviewed his analysis and said, well, yes, you're quite right. This map, the Peary Reese map, does show accurately what the outlines of the Queen Maud land of Antarctica is beneath the ice.
Rand, would you stay with me for another 15 minutes? We'll take
sure.
a break here.
Okay.
This is Rand Flem Ath. He and his wife, Rose, have compiled some of the most interesting information about Atlantis and the proof that it actually existed. So his book is Atlantis Beneath the Ice. We're going to come back in just a few minutes, and we're going to talk about some of the things that they've discovered that existed in places that they shouldn't have been at all, according to experts of the time. Well, this is Donna Sebo. We're coming back to discuss a little bit more of Atlas Beneath the Ice. Don't go away.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and my guest today is Rand Flamath. He and his wife, Rose, spent years doing research, traveling to England, talking with people, having adventures, all of which are mentioned in their new book, Atlantis Beneath the Ice. Now, they had written a book in 95 titled When the Sky Fell. So this information, if you're just joining us, what we're discussing for the next quarter hour is some of the details in the material that they researched that I found really fascinating. Rand, in 2004, there were Russian scientists that were astonished to discover certain things in Siberia. Now, this is well within the Arctic Circle. Cold,
yes.
Cold. Huge volume of ice. But this is what they found. 33,000 years ago, it's hard to even wrap your mind around that kind of a number. 33,000 years ago, humans cohabited in this area, it's called Yana, with animals that could not possibly survive there now. They found evidence of mammoths, rhinoceros, bison, horse, reindeer, muskox, wolf, polar fox, a lion, brown bear, wolverine. Holy Moses, that is exciting.
It is, and because this is at today, that latitude is 71 degrees north, and you know, 66 is the Arctic Circle. So this is 5 degrees within the Arctic Circle during what geologists are calling an ice age. So during an ice age, supposedly, in Siberia, just 5 degrees within the Arctic Circle, they're finding humans living with all these temperate zone animals. And this just does not make any sense according to what our traditional knowledge is, theories of geology are being taught in universities and schools around the world today.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no way that works, you see. And bear in mind that these 9 Russian scientists are all members of the Russian Academy of Science, and this was published in Science Magazine, the most prestigious science magazine in the world. And so there's no doubt about the facts. The facts are as you very well stated them, humans living there. And the significance of this is, here's this big, big deal. If you go through from Niana, if you go right straight through the center of the Earth and you pop out on the other side of the Earth, you end up in Lesser Antarctica. That is the part of Antarctica that's close to South America. And that's the side of Antarctica that we believe Atlantis existed. So if people were living in Yana 33,000 years ago, that isn't that opens up the door that people could be living in Lesser Antarctica at the same time. Because as we know, every place on the Earth's surface has an opposite. The North Pole is the opposite to the South Pole. But any point on the Earth has an opposite. And in every case, you have similar amounts of annual sunfall. And so you get similar temperatures. Now, climate is, of course, controlled by more than just the amount of sunshine you get. There's also winds, ocean currents, etc. But the fact that we have in northern Siberia, well within today's Arctic Circle, these people living with these temperate zone animals in the Arctic means that the same thing could be happening in the Antarctic, and that opens up the possibility that Antarctica is not the frozen continent that geology teaches, that its history is not as well understood as many geologists believe it is. We believe that the ancient maps that show its features subglacially, things like this Yana, bring into question everything that we think we know about Antarctica. We believe that Antarctica was a third of it, and Antarctica is a huge continent. It's the size of 48 states combined would be still smaller than Antarctica. And the section of Antarctica towards South America would be the size of about Western Europe. The other side, which is called Greater Antarctica, towards Australia and the Indian Ocean, even during the time of Atlantis, this was under ice. But you still had a continent that was as big as Western Europe, and we believe humans could have lived there, and Plato's account, we believe, points directly to Antarctica as being the location of the lost continent.
Elizabeth Gould Davis,
yes,
noted that Plato had written that the Atlanteans enjoyed equal rights. Mm-hmm. And she went on to say that public offices were held by women as well as men. Mm-hmm. Women had advantages of education. They were highly respected. And I had fascinating correlation information that you have here about a tribe called the Yagan.
Yes.
And that tribe, you believe, had some link historically with the Atlanteans because in their tribe, the women had roles as shamans. They really were, it sounded like, almost like a matriarchal society. Women were taught to swim. Men were forbidden to marry within the tribe, and they had to go on sea quests to find wives, which I found extremely interesting. And there was a young man whose body was found in 2008 that is related to these people. They did a DNA sample on it, and they feel that he was in this particular area. He probably had gone on a quest. And how long ago was that?
Well, that was 10,000 years ago. He traveled from the southern tip of South America to Alaska. He showed up in the Prince of Wales Island, which is one of the southern islands of Alaska. When the body was originally discovered, they thought, "Oh, wow, excellent! This is going to prove exactly what we've always believed, which is that people are coming from Siberia and arriving in North America from Asia." But when they did the genetic tests of it, he had a unique genetic characterization, which only appears, which is most predominant, let's put it this way, it refers with most frequency in this area of the southern tip of South America, in the tribe that you were mentioning. And we believe that this guy went on a great quest, and you know, it's 10,000 years ago. And he made his way all the way up, all the way from the southern tip of South America to the panhandle of Alaska, and then died there. So there are a couple of other people, some in California and Mexico, that have this same genetic code, but it's far less frequent than the one in the southern tip of South America. The other thing about the people that live there, and we have again dates for occupation that date to exactly around, well, within 200. The margin of error in some of these radiocarbons can be up to 200 years, but it overlaps with the 9,600 BC. And so you have, at the same time that the Göbekli Tepe is getting these monuments in Turkey, and the temple is being built in the Sphinx, and the stuff is happening in Lake Titicaca and Tiahuanaco, you have occupation occurring in the southern tip of South America. When you look into the mythology of South America, particularly at Lake Titicaca, that area, which became ultimately part of the Inca Empire, they have a story that their ancestors came from the south after a great flood. Mm-hmm. This is completely contrary to what archaeology teaches, is that everything is coming from Siberia, either through an ice-free corridor or along the coast. But what the people in South America are saying is completely different. They're saying, no, our people came from the south at the time of the Great Flood, and they brought with them the knowledge of agriculture, which they passed on to the people in the vicinity of Lake Titicaca. Now, what we have in Lake Titicaca is many, many of the important crops of the world, potatoes. There wouldn't be potatoes without what happened at Lake Titicaca. Mm-hmm. 11,500 years ago.
And also quinoa is there.
Absolutely, yes. And mm-hmm. guinea pigs. There's a whole array of domesticated animals and plants that were happening there, llamas, that were happening around that time. And the story that people say, which is completely diametrically opposed to what archaeology teaches, is that they came from the south, and that they came there with the knowledge of agriculture. The other thing, then the same thing that happens when you talk about the peopling of America in general, most archaeologists are still fixed on this notion that people came from Siberia. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't a relationship between the people in Siberia and the people in North America, but which the direction was it came is still, it's difficult to tell directions within mm-hmm. archaeology. Mm-hmm. But what we are being told is that people came to the New World, you know, sort of as almost like pioneers looking for a new land or something. But that's not the story that the people say. I mean, when you start to listen to the stories of the people from all the way across the North America, it's a different story. And the story is this. We were catastrophically displaced from our original island homeland at a time mm-hmm. of a great flood. We did not want to be here. We ended up here. That's how we got here. It wasn't a question of leaving someplace because they wanted to and going to someplace that was promising. It was a question of someplace that was promising was being destroyed, and they had to leave. So the story that the people who have lived here for thousands of years say is completely and absolutely diametrically opposed to what the archaeologists are saying or what is supposed to have happened.
And Rand, you know, we're just about out of time. And for those of you listening, I strongly encourage you to pick up a copy of Atlantis Beneath the Ice. It is absolutely amazing. Now, you can go to Rand's website. It's flim-ath.com. That's F like Frank, L like Lucy, E like Edward, M like Mary, dash, A like Adam, T like Tom, H like Henry.com. Slimass.com. Rand, this is just fascinating. You've got information about the Earth shift, so many points of interest. I know anybody that picks up this book is just going to find it extremely interesting. And I'm so grateful you were on the show with me today. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. It was great fun.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break for just a moment. Check out Atlantis Beneath the Ice, Fate of the Lost Continent. It is an excellent read. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Well, I was totally fascinated with the subject. I hope you were as well, and there's so much more we could have covered, but my goodness, we just didn't have the time for it. Quickly, I want to mention that my class, Quantum Mind 3, is coming up on April the 14th. We're taking registration now for the class. This is going to be held at Bridgeport Place in University Place, and it is going to be on that Saturday, the 14th of April, from 10 until 4, and lunch is included. The price is $59.95. We're going to be discussing Chinese medicine and its practical applications in everyday life. Robert Newman is going to be presenting that segment of class. And then in the second segment, we're going to be talking about dreams, how you can use them as a tool, how to interpret them, but more than that, how valuable they are as an information resource. Also, we are going to be doing exercises for mind skills. The price for the class is $59.95, and again, that includes lunch. And if you'd like to register for the class, be sure to give me a call, Donna, at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604. If you pay at the door, it's going to be $69.95. So do give me a call. We are just really looking forward to this, and it is going to be an absolutely wonderful class. Each of the Quantum Mind classes have been totally distinct and separate in the information that we've discussed, and I know that this one is going to be just as interesting as the other two. So I hope you will join us. Again, call me at 253-582-5604. Also, I want to let you know that as of May the 1st, showtime for the Donna Sebo Show is going to be moving to 9 a.m. The show will be from 9 to 10 in the morning Pacific time. So wherever you are in the country or in the world, you'll need to do your time adjustment. And again, that starts on May the 1st. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about body ecology with Donna Gates. This woman really has an in-depth perception about wellness and so many aspects of nutrition that I know you'll enjoy her. And then we're going to be talking about free fall with Sally Anderson, who's in New Zealand. And then on Friday, Sally Felton is going to be my guest. We're going to figure out how we can get this clutter all taken care of. It's springtime. It's time to bring everything into its proper place so that we feel good about our time. time that we're going to want to spend playing instead of cleaning and organizing. Anyway, that's our lineup for this week, so I look forward to have you join me. I wanted to share with you today a recipe that I just think is wonderful. And for those of you that might be vegetarians, I think it is absolutely awesome. And for those of you that are not vegetarians, but as the warmer temperatures are coming about, woohoo, we are going to want to look svelte and slim. And so this recipe is made with broccoli rabe, feta cheese, and mint pasta. And of course, you could adapt this if you wanted to. If you weren't fond of feta, you might be able to use a different cheese. But anyway, I think we've got a caller. Let's take our caller first, and then I'll give you this recipe. Super easy. Hello, welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Hi, Donna. It's Pat from Connecticut.
Well, hi, Pat from Connecticut. Snow gone, weather warming up, flowers blooming.
Oh, we had a very warm winter, and today we had cold weather.
Oh, come on. You mean you've got those weather gnomes operating? Oh, my goodness.
No.
They're having a field day this year, I think.
Yes.
All right. There. First thing that I'm looking at with you is a setback, and it looks like you're going to be perturbed over this setback. But actually, it's going to end up turning out to be an advantage to you, because it's going to force you to slow down, step back, reevaluate, reassess your facts, and then you're going to say, okay, I know what to do. And you're going to find that you're adaptable and you're able to adjust certain things and everything's going to fall into place. So I think that even though there is, maybe I'll use a different word, a disappointment, it's going to serve you so that you are able to flip that disappointment into something that is going to be a positive result. But you have to be mindfully alert and aware. But again, being forced to slow down to change your perspective is going to be a very good thing. Now, I know we're almost out of time, dear. Did you want to ask a question?
Yeah. Can I ask, does that have to do with work by any chance?
I honestly don't know right at this moment.
Okay. All right, I don't know if it's okay to ask about someone else, but I'm concerned.
Sure.
I just got news that someone's going to be tested. He's got neurological problems. It could be anything from Lyme disease to terminal, and I'm just very concerned.
Okay, what's his first initial?
C.
Okay. With C, it's not so simple as just one item. C has had a number of things that have been going awry in his body for over 10 years. So we're not looking at something that can just be pasted with a label. There's going to have to be more of an investigation, in my observation, than just putting a label on it. Because I think that there is a multiple aspect here that has compounded to the point that it has affected his neurological system in a very intense way. And he's not really done a very good job of taking care of himself anyway. He's like so many people. He figures he's as strong as steel, and if he ignores it, it's just going to go away. Well, regrettably, it doesn't work that way. And
right.
In his case, this is a culmination of many things, not just a single element.
Do you see it possibly terminal?
It could be, but I don't think it is. It could be, but again, there's so many things going on here.
Right.
That I would not focus on that. I would focus on sending him energy of support, and don't come from a point of fear. Say, okay, let's see what we can do to find out what you need to know to take care of yourself.
Right.
Kat,
and
I'm sorry. I hate to cut you off here, but
thank
I'm out of time.
Thank you so much, Donna. God bless you.
Thank you, dear.
Bye-bye.
Bless you, too. This is Donna Sebo. I'll be back here, same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Take care. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.